Welcome back to another episode of This Is Why We Watch Movies. I'm Brian J. Hutchins, and I'm, as always, joined by
Landon Higgs.
And today we're going to be talking about some really fun stuff, which you probably already know about because it's in the description. But anyways, we're going to pretend that you don't know. How's your day been, man?
It's been okay. I had some classes, and then I made it here, so not too much going on.
Typical film student life, I must say.
Absolutely.
So I actually had a very interesting day. Something happened.
Okay, let's hear it.
Someone who I kind of work with, like someone in my office suite, is switching jobs, so he had a going away party. And there was someone at this that I went and talked movies with. Not older fellow, but like someone much older than myself. And we were talking about art house films, and he started referencing the movie about the kid growing up in Texas. You know, the art house film. And he was like, I think Terrence Malick directed it. And you might know what this one is, but he was like, I think it was called Boyhood.
Oh my God.
And so I was like, no, that's Linklater. And he goes, oh, of course. I love Linklater. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. But
that makes me very angry. And I'm spoiler alert for later in the show. I am going to bring up Tree of Life. So just
I was
be prepared.
Too, but anyways, the funny thing about that though, is that when I was like, oh, you're thinking of Tree of Life, not Boyhood. He compared them as very similar films. And then when I thought about it thematically, they might be. They're just very different presentations of the same idea.
I think they're interested in, like, very different things. But, like, I mean, I guess sort of in a way you could connect them, but
they're both coming-of-age stories set in Austin, Texas.
That's probably where the comparison would stop for me. But
yeah, that's totally fair. But anyways, that's how my day was. Well, on our last episode, we discussed the Oscar nominations for 2023's films, which, of course, happens in 2024. And there were several that we hadn't seen. So I think it would be safe to say that rectifying that situation has been a big goal of ours recently.
Absolutely.
So this weekend, we went and saw American Fiction down at the Regal, and we're going to talk about that now. So for those of you that don't know, it's a new film with Jeffrey Wright and Sterling K. Brown. I forget who directed it.
Cord Jefferson, I believe, is his
name. That's correct, Cord Jefferson. I should have wrote that down. And I'm not sure if it's his first film, but
yeah, it's his directorial debut. He's been writing on TV for a while. Like, he's worked on, like, Succession and some other things. So
yeah, so really strong debut, I must say. And I was surprised to learn that it was produced by Rian Johnson and Ron Bergman.
Yeah, it's like the credits started rolling, and we just kind of looked at each other and just gave each other the nod.
Like, wow.
Yeah.
Anyways, what were your thoughts on the movie?
Well, first, I just want to say that I'm very excited to hear what you have to say, because I think that both of us are going to be pretty high on this movie. But we did not speak on it yesterday after leaving the theater. We decided to wait and do this fresh.
We even drove separately.
We did. So the first thing I want to say about the movie is it is incredibly witty. To me, I think that every time I expected something in this movie to happen, it would happen in a completely different way. It subverts expectations at every turn. I don't want to get into specifics just for spoiler's sake, but, even the third act, the way that it ends, I think, it's going to subvert your expectations. This is not going to be the movie that you expect it to be going in.
Right. I think that the trailers somewhat painted it as a straightforward dramedy almost, and it's definitely not that.
Yeah, definitely not. To me, I think the strength of this is actually kind of in that subversion and also in the performance from Jeffrey Wright.
Yeah.
Because this movie's really two different movies that kind of merged together. One being a...
Is that your brother?
It is, yeah. Shut I put up. It on Do Not Disturb. It's still disturbing me.
Hey,
so
he probably hit the button.
Yeah, you he probably did.
Come on.
Sorry, I forgot where I was now.
Oh, two different movies.
Yeah, this is a satire in one half, and the other half is a family drama. To me, I think the family drama is a little stronger for me. I wish that the satire was a little more biting than it was. It was kind of obvious to me. Every kind of turn kind of felt like exactly where that would go, where the rest of the film was constantly making me think and question where we were going next.
Sure.
So I think that was kind of a problem for me.
I was going to get into my problems a bit later, but I just realized that we never recapped what it was about. So it's about a professor who is fed up with the American novel business and market, the way that publishing works, and how his thought-provoking novels generally never get... they do get published, but they're not widely spread with recognition or... not box office success. I don't know what it's called within book sales. But anyways, he's not a bestseller.
Right.
So he ends up writing something which could be argued to be a blaxploitation novel, and has it published under a pseudonym, and it becomes like his most popular piece ever, and everyone loves it, and he doesn't understand why. So a big part of it is dealing with identity, I think. Like, when I break down the story, it's him wrestling with, like, his identity and who he is and who he wants to be versus what society expects him to be. And that was the profound part of it for me. I wrote down a reference, but when I was watching it, I couldn't help but think about the English teacher at the end of The Amazing Spider-Man 1. A very strange anecdote, but it brings me back to that when she's like, there's only one story in all of fiction, and that's who am I? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Peter's late. He actually missed that. And he's like, I'm going to break every promise. But anyways, I definitely got that vibe from it. Like, that's really the point of the story, if right. I were to break it down.
Yeah. I think the movie's more interested in the family drama side of it than the actual, like, satire of it. Which, again, at points does it well. But other points, I feel like it was a weird mix of family drama and satire. Like, I feel like in some points of the movie, it's mixed well. Other parts, it's like, I don't know, I feel like we're spending too much time here.
Right, like, excuse me, something that I put down in the cons section, I felt like the pacing was somewhat choppy, and that's how I would describe what you're talking about.
Yeah, for
sure. They're two very different stories that are just kind of mixed together.
Right.
And it skips around between them, and there's a lot of time jumps, actually. And that's something I wasn't expecting, and it was kind of difficult to tell how long it had been since something happened.
Yeah, I think that the only thing to me that really works is, like, connecting the two is I think that Jeffrey Wright's performance, I feel like when you're watching him interact with his family, you can kind of, like, subtly kind of see the selfishness kind of beneath his kind of self-righteous attitude towards literature, even stuff that's not, like, black author related. He has a self-righteousness about what he makes. He feels like it's better than the garbage, as he would call it. Me, you can kind of subtly see where he's coming from through his interactions with his family. To me, that was interesting.
Yeah, yeah. He definitely, like, even his, clearly he doesn't have his life together, minor spoiler.
Correct.
It turns out no one in his family really does, but for some reason he still acts like he has it more together than his brother or
right, he's
his
constantly
mom.
Judging yeah. when he probably shouldn't be.
And that leads into a lot of the, I think, the best jokes in the movie coming from, like, I think there's an early scene in a bookstore when he's pissed off that his books are in the black authors section instead of just in the...
In the African-American studies.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that was hilarious. Talking about the satire, I think that it definitely, the opening of the film started... I don't know how far we want to go into spoilers or anything, but the opening gag involved the N-word and an offended college student. And it felt kind of like South Park.
Mm.
I'm almost positive I've seen that bit, maybe in a slightly different form on South Park.
I could probably see that for sure, yeah.
I mean, clearly this was funnier, but...
Well, I don't know.
I'm not a fan. At other times, it felt not disingenuous, but I think that what am I looking for here? Did this film pass the Bechdel test? I don't think it did.
No, I don't think so.
It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like for it to have passed the Bechdel test.
Again, that's apparently is really difficult. I don't know.
I mean, I've never written anything that passes the Bechdel test.
Well. Maybe you should rectify that. You know?
I'm working on it.
All right.
I don't know why I whispered that. What else you got?
I kind of think we should move into spoilers if we're going to continue the conversation to me, because I think that there's some interesting things to talk about.
That's fair.
Yeah. I think we've kind of touched on everything generally that we wanted to. I think it'd be interesting to talk spoilers.
Yeah, let's do it.
I want to start with the ending. I want to know, number one, what you thought of the ending.
So I actually put the ending into a cons section. And here's the thing. I didn't dislike the ending. Mm-hmm. Can I say what it is?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, for sure.
Cool. So if you're listening, this is your own fault. The movie very much so leads up to a particular point, and then following that, it turns out that some of what we've been seeing is Monk, the main character, pitching the story to a film director or producer. And it reminded me a lot of the ending of Gerwig's Little Women. Mm. But it wasn't satisfying in the same way. They used it for more satire to bring back in the same points. I think where it lacks satisfaction for me is that I'm now not sure if any of the movie was actually what happened to the character, or if the only time we see the real him is when he's pitching this this story.
Yeah, I think that American Fiction as a title, I think, gives away a lot of what, kind of what the ending is getting at, is that, yeah, everything that we saw leading up to that, I don't know that we saw a real story. I think it may have just been, you know, fiction to Monk.
Right.
But to me, it worked, because the whole movie is about subverting what people's expectations for you are. And I could not have guessed in a million years that's how that movie would have ended.
No, that's not where I thought it was going to go. Now, the ending that he pitches, where he gets killed by the police for pretending to be a criminal, I thought that was actually pretty good.
Yeah, that was interesting. But to me, it's funny because, you know, he gets in the car with his brother and he drives off, and it fades to black. And then there was a person sitting right in front of us who was just like, what? just scream, like just audibly distraught by this ending. But yeah. No, I think the ending works for me.
I can't accept this as being the reality.
Yeah, because it doesn't tie up any of these like loose ends that we've been following this whole movie, really.
No.
He has one moment with his brother. But
he may not have even had that moment.
Yeah, he has this girlfriend that he's had this big argument with, and now we don't have any resolution for that. The only thing we know is that she's not spoken to him since.
Right.
Or she won't return his text messages.
We don't even know what the argument was, really, because of the way that it's presented.
Correct. We don't know what actually happened. Yeah. So, there is a part that's like, you kind of wish it maybe had a little bit of a resolution. But to me, I think this ending worked really well.
No, I think it works well, but it still bothers me.
Yeah, that's totally fair.
I guess recently I watched something that dealt with someone dealing with this exact question, and that would be The Fault in Our Stars, which I'm about to read. I've been on a John Green kick recently. But, you know, in that, the main point of Hazel's journey is that she's not sure what happens after she dies to the people that she loves, but it's because she read a book in which the main character dies, and then it just ends. There is no resolution. And so it, in a lot of ways, reminded me of that feeling that this character in The Fault in Our Stars must have felt, except clearly I'm not dying, so I don't have the same.
Yeah, you're not dying, yeah.
Not yet.
Yeah. Actually, we all are. Act accordingly.
Yeah, that's true. But, I think that's probably the big thing. Overall, I felt like the characters outside of Monk could have been developed a lot better. Like, Sterling K. Brown's acting is excellent, and this really solidifies him as a character actor for me.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have thought of him as that previously, because, like, my main exposure to him would have been This Is Us, right?
Okay.
And outside of that, like, Black Panther, The Predator, and...
Was he in Black Panther?
Yeah, he was Killmonger's dad.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Right, but that's the epitome of a character actor. You forget that they're in something.
Fair enough.
So I think that this role solidifies that, because it's also like a big break from other kinds of roles that we've seen him in.
Mm-hmm.
I know I looked at you and was like, it's the guy from Frozen 2.
Oh, my God.
Which is true.
Yeah. I remember that. We talked about that when we watched it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know how you feel about that. Like, but I personally felt like most of the characters were a bit underdeveloped outside of Wright.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, even the mother, I thought it was like, I don't know, it was a weird, like, they were like, oh, she's got, like, was it Alzheimer's?
It was dementia, yeah.
Yeah, and to me, I don't know, I don't feel like we learned much about her outside of that, to me, like, to be honest.
No, it was very one note. And even like his girlfriend, maybe the only added dimension to her, and we're still in spoiler territory, everyone, is when he realizes that she read the blaxploitation novel that he wrote, and he just gets really pissed off.
Yeah.
Like, how can you like me and also like this? Is kind of his.
Again, it's that pretension. That, like, he's such a...
He's a douche.
He's very much that. Like, he
definitely watches Terrence Malick movies.
Oh, 100%. And he probably, like, plays them through the wall so that his roommate has to listen to them.
That's just culture.
No, it's just called annoying.
Oh. I do have a confession, though.
All right, let's hear it.
Remember the piece of chocolate last week?
Yes.
I ate it.
No. This is the end of the podcast.
No, it's not. But speaking of immaculate things, like chocolate.
Okay.
The lighting in this movie was really awesome. I think the outdoor sequences on the beach used a lot of natural light, beautiful sunsets, and it was like a fine chocolate, I must say.
I would say other than that, the lighting to me didn't necessarily strike any kind of chords with me. It kind of felt pretty... You know, it was kind of low-key lighting to me. Like, you know, not much going on there.
Right. Like, outside, that's what I'm saying, is that the outside bits were great. But inside,
it's the outside, like, stuff was great.
There's not a lot of motivation for it to be, like, a specific type of thing.
Yeah.
I do feel like I'm more like Monk than I'd like to admit, though. And we've kind of already hit up on that.
Mm. I think we both can be. Let's be real about it.
Well, yeah, you over there on your side of the table with your ghost. I'm over here with Terry, you know.
Yeah, terrible Terry.
Yeah. But I really loved his character. I'm trying to think if there's anything else specifically about the film's production. Okay, score. It was nominated for score.
Yeah.
I really don't understand that.
Me neither.
It's not that fantastic. Again,
it just solidifies to me more that Spider-Verse should have been there.
Yeah. I didn't find that to be what it should be. I think this was nominated in one of the screenwriting categories as well.
That makes sense.
I feel like it has a chance down there for sure.
Yeah. This would be adapted screenplay.
Adapted screenplay. Yeah. Right. Maybe it doesn't have a chance down there. But what I will say, back into like Oscar chances for this, because that's still kind of relevant. I don't think that Wright's performance is going to win. There's no offense to him.
Right. I think it's a really, like, it's a tough, that's a tough category this year.
It's a tough category, and I don't, it's not that I didn't feel anything from him, because I did. I really loved his performance. It's just, I didn't think it was, like, a game-changing performance.
No, I would agree. But maybe that's more to do with him, that, like, you know what he's going to bring, and, like, you know, so you, this is an expected performance almost from him.
Right. Like, he brought what I wanted him to bring.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm not mad at that. Now, Sterling K. Brown, on the other hand, I could see him having a chance over and supporting. I mean, you have the likes of RDJ and Gosling, but his performance, I think, going back to the whole character actor thing, just like showing up and being someone else, I really feel that he did that in this.
Oh, for sure. But I think the big problem with that is just, like, again, it seems like a problem with a lot of the supporting actors is, like, he's a little bit underutilized. Like, he's in and out. Like, he'll be there, and then, like, towards the end, he's in it much more. But, like, I feel like there's a good chunk of this movie that he just kind of disappears.
Yeah, that's part of his journey, I guess. But
right.
It also, that's when it becomes more rom-commy is when he leaves specifically.
Which, that section of the film, to me, was...
That's the weakest
part. It's the weakest part, yeah.
So, we are in agreement that the strongest part is the family drama, specifically, at the beginning. The first act of this movie is...
Yeah, and I will say this, since we're in spoilers. Like, so, this movie starts, and it's a writer who goes back home, and I go, okay, I know this story.
Right.
And it's like his sister and him are going to have to figure out how they're going to take care of his mom, how they're going to do this. His sister just dies. Like, she has a heart attack and just dies. Like, that was the first time in the movie that, like, the movie goes in a direction I wasn't necessarily expecting it to. And then I think that they use the subverting the expectations to their jokes hit harder. Because, like, the jokes come out of no. Like, you expect the joke to go one way and it just goes somewhere else. It was, like, it was insane.
Yeah, I've long talked about this, that I think the way to approach comedy is the same way you approach narrative, mm-hmm. right? You're writing every scene with its own little micro three-act structure. So, you know, you have your starting incident, rising action, and then your climax and resolution. But I think with comedy, you think of it as the punchline and everything going up there to that being the climax, but it subverts what's supposed to happen. So it's like societal norms follow that three-act structure, mm-hmm. and then you just don't do it.
Right.
And this film utilizes that to a T, and I think also on a deeper, like, narrative level as well, not just within the jokes, but within the actual structure of the film.
Right. I think actually one more kind of subversion moment that I really enjoyed was when he's at the dinner with the TV exec, and he looks out and he sees the ambulance. So he assumes that it was his mom who is, you know, had a problem. He runs over there, and he gets up there, and his mom is fine. It was some guy on the floor below them, and, like, it's a funny thing. But then, like, the joke kind of hits afterwards when he's like, the guy said, you say you heard police sirens and ran. So that's the reason that he was like,
he's hardcore.
It was very clever when it came to the jokes. Like, to me, that was the strength of this movie, because it was really funny.
Yeah. I don't think I've laughed particularly this much at a comedy film in a while. I mean, anyone but you, probably.
Yeah, that was funny.
But this was, like, funnier on a like, academic level.
Right.
Anyone but you is, like, how do I describe it? It's like TikTok jokes almost.
Yeah,
I mean, this is, like, intellectual jokes.
I mean, there's
this place
for
YouTube
both.
This is the YouTube of jokes.
Which I think is the point of the movie. The point of the movie, there's room for both.
Right.
Like, you
there,
don't have
there
to just,
be.
Yeah.
I think that's where it gets interesting, is, like, the whole outside of the family drama, mm-hmm. this question of, like, art, what is art, and the attachment of oneself to the art.
Right.
I talked about this, you know, 20 minutes ago, but the something that I heard, I think it's the lady who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, gave mm-hmm. a TED Talk. I highly encourage you to go walk it. Yeah, I highly encourage you to go watch it. It's fantastic. Okay. But she was talking about the idea of the muse that ancient cultures had, or even Shakespeare, where it's like when something creative happens, it's not you. Mm-hmm. It happens from somewhere else. And if it's bad, well, your muse just wasn't, like, with it today. Mm. But there's no beating yourself up over that. Or right. sometimes your muse does great, but it's not you, and it keeps your ego kind of leveled. And I think that when you look at Monk as a character, he does not have that philosophy.
He does not, no.
It is all entirely him.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like, I am this genius writer whose work is too smart for the average viewer. Like, that's kind of where he sits. That's why he's like, I'm not successful because I'm too smart, almost.
Right. Like, he takes his lack of success in, not in stride, but in just, like, I didn't need it anyways.
Right.
I don't know. I just think that's the interesting part of his character. But it even comes, like, it comes back to him being like, I'm too smart for my family. Everyone in his family was a doctor. And he is, too, just not in the medical field. He's a doctor of English.
Right.
So, I don't know. I found that to be everything about his character to be interesting. Like, mm-hmm. it's well written. But in terms of performance, like, it's just Jeffrey Wright.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that 100%, but, like, we're kind of in the same area on it.
Yeah.
So what did you end up, like, giving it score-wise?
That's a great question. 4.5 out of 5.
Oh, okay. Okay. I gave it a 4 out of 5.
Okay.
So, yeah, we're in the same ballpark.
I generally am a bit less harsh than you when it comes to this sort of thing.
I think it depends on the type of movie. I think, like, this one is more in your wheelhouse than it is mine.
That's totally fair. Yeah, I legitimately enjoyed this. The things that I've mentioned as being, like, minor cons really are just minor to me.
Yeah.
Like, I was looking at my list of 2023 films. I think I'm going to rank this one as 2024 just because, like, it, even though Oscar-wise it's last year, it didn't release here until 24.
But, okay.
It's the best thing I've seen this year for sure.
I mean, yeah, but that's...
That's not saying much because it was Mean Girls and... Founder's Day, if you count that, but we kind of left.
Yeah, we didn't. We watched maybe 10 minutes of that movie.
Yeah. No offense to the filmmakers, if you ever hear this.
I'll eventually give it another shot, but
it's just not for me.
It wasn't for me that day. There was a football game on. It was the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah, so 4 out of 5 and 4.5 out of 5. So we can say that the conglomerate review is 4.25.
Yep.
Yeah, which is not a thing. But if you're interested in movie reviews that Landon and I have, just overall what we're watching, we are avid fans of the app Letterboxd. I'm not going to tell you what our usernames are right here, but if you go look in the description of the show, you can see them. He and I watch a lot of stuff together, but we also watch stuff separately.
Yep.
And we make our own lists with very different opinions on things.
Oh, we, yes, drastically.
So I highly recommend following us. If you are interested in, like, branching out from, I guess, like, multiplex movies or, like, your traditional streaming stuff. I watch a lot of classic movies, and I recently have been doing rewatches, but generally I don't. You can look through and see that, though. But anyways, we have compiled a list today in honor of Letterboxd about our favorite movies about writers. And ironically, I would put American Fiction on this list.
Okay.
But I decided not to.
Yeah, I did too.
So I'm curious what you have. I didn't rank them. It's just a list of 5.
Okay. So do you want to do like, we'll each do for like 1 and then we'll just kind of go back and forth on that?
That sounds good to me.
Okay. So I'll just go ahead and just name my honorable mentions because I don't have much to say about them. My 2 honorable mentions are The Ghost Writer. It's kind of a political drama about a writer who's writing a memoir for a political figure. It stars Ewan McGregor. It's actually quite interesting. And then Ace in the Hole was directed by Billy Wilder. Okay. I think those two are two you should check out for sure.
I actually do have an honorable mention, but the reason it's down here is because it's a TV show.
Okay.
And it's also not on Letterboxd. Gilmore Girls. Fantastic TV show.
Okay.
Rory goes to, I forget where she went. I think she goes to Yale for journalism. But there are several author characters or writer characters in the show. It's not entirely about that. It's about a lot more, but it's a fantastic show.
Okay. So my number 5 is Samuel Fuller's Shock Corridor from 1963. Okay. So this is a film about a journalist who is trying to win a Pulitzer, and he goes into a mental institution to try to solve this murder that's been happening. And this film, to me, I think, is interesting for a number of reasons. It has a lot to say about race in the 60s and also about how we deal with mental illness. So that's my number 5.
All right, so my number 5, my list is so bad. Nim's Island, which I saw.
What is Nim's Island?
You've never seen Nim's Island.
No.
I believe it's Jodie Foster and Gerard Butler and Abigail Breslin.
Okay.
It is about a girl who lives with her father on an island, and he's like researching something, and she's obsessed with this author named Alexandra Rover.
Okay.
That writes a series of action novels called Alex Rover. And so she always reads these books. But the real Alex Rover, the author, emails her dad.
Okay.
Asking, like, research questions for the next novel. And the kid thinks that it's, like, the guy Alex Rover. And so then something happens to her dad, and she sends, like, a distress email to the author, and then the author has to go to the island and help her. It's a very, like, botched kids movie from the mid-2000s for sure.
Okay.
But it's, you know, it's a fun time. It's a family movie. Gerard Butler. You can't go wrong with Gerard Butler. I mean, come on.
Well, you can.
You can, but we're not going to talk about that.
Yeah. Let's not.
For some reason, this was the first movie I thought of when you were like, let's make a list of movies about writers.
That was the one.
That's the one.
Okay. Well, I mean, it definitely sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Other than you saying it was a botched kids movie, but...
I mean, think like Bridge to Terabithia, but less interesting.
Less traumatizing?
Less traumatizing.
Okay. Okay, so moving on from that, my number 4 is Misery from 1990, directed by Rob Reiner. And this is about a writer named Paul Sheldon who writes Misery novels. It's, you know, basically like a romance kind of in the vein of like a Pride and Prejudice, I guess. And he decides he's going to kill off one of his characters. Well, one night he has a wreck on the road and is picked up by his biggest fan. And then horror ensues. This one to me is interesting, just kind of kind of talking about how, honestly, this probably is more poignant now when we kind of talk about fandom and how people react to things that they don't like in movies that they love. To me, I think that there's a lot to say about that in this one. So I think that one's an interesting one to check out.
I see. So my next movie on the list is Zodiac.
Okay.
Which is a David Fincher film from 2007 with an ensemble cast about the investigation into the Zodiac killer in California. Mm-hmm. I believe you've seen it. You're a big Fincher fan.
I watched it recently, yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's a fun, well, it's not a fun movie, but it's an interesting movie, and it definitely deals with writers, like the journalist that broke the story. So, yeah, that's definitely up there for a bit of a taste breaker.
Yeah, for sure. So my number three is the Coen brothers' Barton Fink from 1991. And this one's interesting to me. It's just, it's about a writer who goes out to L.A. to write a wrestling film. And he has a lot of feelings about it. This one, I think, actually connects most to American Fiction for me. Because it's about a guy who is struggling dealing with, like, ideas of, like, creative integrity. And, like, an artist, like, kind of being an egomaniac a little bit. So I think those two kind of connected the most for me when I thought about it.
I see. I have another journalism movie up next.
Okay.
It's a Steven Spielberg movie.
Ah.
From 2017.
Yep.
Titled The Post.
Yeah.
About the breaking of the... I forgot what the papers were called, but it's basically the breaking of the Watergate scandal.
Mm-hmm.
The Pentagon Papers, that's what it was. Right. This is Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep and a few other people. It's a pretty fun movie, I'd say. It's definitely not one of Spielberg's best movies, but that's because we're talking about Spielberg.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very competent movie, and it's interesting because it definitely deals with, like, the ethos of journalism and the ethics of actually publishing this thing.
Yeah, I think most people, like, most filmmakers would be, like, happy to have this as in, like, their top three movies. But Spielberg, it's probably not even in the top 15.
I was going to say, I think for me it's in... I think I've seen 25 Spielberg movies, and this was towards, like, 18, possibly.
But it's still good.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Yeah. It's just maybe not as exciting as the other ones.
Right. You know? Yeah.
So, for me, number two is one that I'm surprised you hadn't mentioned yet. Maybe not. I don't know. Is The Shining, because we talked about this last night. But, like, this is just a movie about a guy who's... going to be a caretaker of a hotel who is also trying to write while he's there. And then, you know, things go haywire. I don't really know what to say about The Shining that hasn't already been said. Like, I feel like it's like such a well-trodden, like such a well-trodden path that I don't think I can bring anything new to that conversation.
You know, I agree with that. Something interesting that I can bring to this conversation is that I had to watch it for my Kubrick class back in undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom had never seen it.
Oh, really?
And this was my first time seeing it, too. So I was like, cool. So I actually got to experience watching The Shining with my mom for the first time together. And her reaction to it was along the lines of, this is horrible. Like, anytime... Aww. There's only, like, three deaths in the movie. But she was just like, this is messed up. And then, like, didn't leave the room. But I was like, you know, you can leave.
You know what's interesting about The Shining is there's not much in the way of, like, blood and gore in the movie, like, that you see on camera. Like, you see that there's clearly been something going on. You know, there's blood running through down the elevators and stuff. But a lot of it's just...
It's in your head.
It's all in your head, and it's creepy. Just for that simple reason, it's like, it's what you can come up with in your own head, and that's way scarier than anything they could have filmed. It's brilliant.
I concur on that 100%. The next film on my list, number two, is Stranger Than Fiction, which last night I actually said I mentioned the wrong director. It's by Mark Forster.
So
he made this film, and his follow-up to it was Quantum of Solace.
Oh.
Right. And he's had a very strange career, like bouncing back and forth. But this movie is about a gentleman who starts hearing a novel's narration in his head.
Oh, wow.
And it's dictating what he's doing. And so then he tries to, like, break from what the novel voice is telling him to do, and he doesn't know what's going on until one day he he goes to a literature professor and is like, help me. And he's like, well, this story sounds like an author I know. Mm-hmm. And somehow there's an author who has been suffering from writer's block, but has literally written every detail of this man's life into a novel. And she's getting ready to type the ending in which he's going to die.
Oh, no.
And so the question of the movie is, like, does she kill this man literally with her words or let him live? And he's wrestling with his mortality because he's like, I thought I was real and I'm in a novel, but he is real. And it's a very fascinating movie. So this is Will Ferrell, Emma Thompson, and Dustin Hoffman. Mm. Love it.
Okay. So my number one is one that I watched last semester for the first time. It is Sunset Boulevard by Billy Wilder. This one to me is interesting. It's about a writer who is financially in trouble. He's like, you know, he's about to lose his car, and he ends up stumbling across Norma Desmond, who is an aging movie star who has been on her way out. She hasn't been in anything recently, and she says, hey, you're going to write my comeback movie. And then it kind of goes haywire from there. But I think that one, to me, when I thought about, like, writers and movies, that's the movie that I thought instantly, because, number one, I just love movies about, like, Hollywood and old Hollywood specifically. And I think this one does it very well. And plus, Billy Wilder's just a genius.
Yeah, that's for sure. I'm saying that. I don't think I've seen any Billy Wilder movies. I keep hearing about them.
You definitely should.
Excuse me. I was going to say, as a film student, it might be sacrilege that I haven't seen them. But I don't know. I feel like I'll get there one day.
Yeah.
Just not this day. Well, my number one is kind of an out-of-pocket movie because it's, you wouldn't expect it. Before Sunset by Richard Linklater. Mm. So in this film, which is the follow-up to the fantastic Before Sunrise, the main character has become, played by Ethan Hawke, has become a famous novelist for writing a book about the night that was depicted in the previous film. And so it opens with him in a bookstore in Paris reading an excerpt from his book, and then the woman who he had the night with 9 years earlier comes to the reading and is like, I'm so glad I found you. And they spend 80 minutes talking.
Yep.
What's fantastic about this movie is it's entirely in real time, mostly a long take. I think that there's like a 17-minute take somewhere in it.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the deal with those.
Well, it's not actually with the first one. The first one's pretty choppy, actually.
The first one has quite a few long takes in it.
Not this long.
No, but...
Yeah, this one, like, takes everything about the first one and does it really well. I actually think this is a rare case where I liked the sequel so much more. The problem I have is I know what happens in Before Midnight, and I don't want to go there.
You definitely should go there.
I should go there. Like, it's been honestly, over a year, and I still haven't watched it.
It always depends on where I'm at in life that, like, I'll have a different favorite of the three. Because I think at any given, like, any point in time, any of them could be my favorites. They're so good.
Yeah. But I'm in a Before Sunset phase these days. That's the one I want.
That's a good one to be in because it's like you just need that happy ending.
Yeah, the third one, not happy.
Well, I mean, I guess depending on who you are, the second one's a happy ending. But
yeah, I mean, I do feel like this one, going back to the writing aspect of it, mm-hmm. the way that he talks about, there's specifically why it always comes up, is he talks about a novel that he wants to work on where it's all about memories, right? So he's like, someone will hear a song, and then it's going to skip back to the first time they heard that song, and it's going to go to someone else and what they were doing when they heard the song. And
interesting.
It's going to keep going, but it's like this one concept, which in his case was a song, is bringing him to all these different memories. And
right.
I don't know. It sounds pretty similar to a project we're currently working on. And
that's right.
I guess there's a reason that I'm attracted to such stories. But yeah. Well, speaking of memories, we watched another thing recently.
We did.
That has a lot to do with memories.
Yeah.
And that film was Interstellar by Christopher Nolan.
Yep.
There's not much to say on this movie that hasn't been said, but this was my second time seeing it in a proper cinema. I think I've seen it 3 times in a cinema, actually, if you count the one here at school. I forgot how quiet this movie was.
Yeah.
It's a very quiet movie.
Yep. It lets you sit with a lot, but then a lot of times it talks too much.
Yeah.
We can get there in a minute, but yeah.
Well, I'm talking about the sound design specifically.
I know what you're saying. Yeah.
I think, like, when you watch it at home, it's easy to be like, I can't understand what they're saying. It's mixed badly, but it's not. It's mixed for, you know, I think the theater we saw it in had 11 speakers all together.
Yeah.
It's mixed for a bigger setup where you can define individual sounds like that.
Right.
I do want to say that the theater we saw it at can suck it. I just had a terrible experience after terrible experience at this place. The only reason we went...
it's never been good.
It was supposed to be in Dolby Atmos with laser projection, and it wasn't. They were like, oh, we're only doing that at noon, and sorry. And so it was a standard show. I'm not going to argue, though. It's a great movie.
I was sick. I was miserable, but I was like, I need to see this.
Yeah, and then it wasn't in PDX, so yeah. I don't know. It was very upsetting. But I was still surprised that the sound did still hit. We were there like 5 minutes late, so I walked in during a talking scene, and my initial thought was like, I can't believe I'm doing this. Like, it's so quiet. I can hear my own thoughts louder than this movie. And then the ship takes off and I'm like, oh, it's just very dynamic.
Yeah. It chooses the moments that it wants to be loud and in your face. That's where I'm at on it. Like, to me, this one is not like egregiously mixed. You know, I think this one's mixed okay compared to like a Tenet, which it's you know, how I feel level. About that. Tenet is awful.
Tenet is actually mixed poorly.
It's bad.
Yeah. So, sound design was the biggest thing that I brought up. And then I think it was interesting seeing the visual effects on a bigger screen. I won't say this was the biggest screen I've seen it on, but it was still nice.
This is the first time I've seen it in the theater, I think. Maybe
you missed it in the original run?
No, I mean, I was going to say since the release, but yeah. Okay. Like, this is the first time I've seen it in the theater since then, which was, what, 2014? So it's been 10 years?
10 years.
Which is crazy, but
are we that old?
We are that old.
Have I known you that long? I haven't known you that long.
No, we have not known. We did not know each other when that came out, no.
I met you shortly after Dunkirk came out.
Correct,
yeah. Because Dunkirk was something we talked about very shortly into knowing each other.
Yeah, that tracks.
That's crazy. So what did you take away from seeing it in a bigger format?
I'm going to start by just go ahead and giving my rating for this movie. Because there's a big asterisk next to this rating. I give this a 5 out of 5. But I'm fully aware of the issues, and I have issues with it. But to me, there's something about this movie that I can't not give it the perfect score.
I think it's because it's a perfect experience watching it.
Maybe that's what it is.
Right.
So the big things about it is, like, it's ambitious. It's massive in scale. It's emotional. It gets me every time. Like, it never fails to make me cry multiple times throughout the movie.
you and me both.
This time specifically, and I think we may have mentioned it after the movie, but, like, the exposition this time kind of got annoying. And I know why it has to be there. Yeah. But, I don't know, sometimes maybe just let the audience be in the dark just a little bit. Like, I think that doesn't hurt.
No, it doesn't hurt. I think that he almost reaches Malick levels of exposition at certain points.
So
that's a joke.
Yeah.
But it's also not a joke. It's kind of true.
Yeah, if there was, like, just random voiceovers throughout the entire movie, I'd be very upset.
It's only in, I think, the final sequence of the movie that we get voiceover.
Right.
But it still has that very much so Malick voiceover feel to it.
Yeah, no, I don't... No, thank you. No, to me, there's something interesting about the movie, and I think that Christopher and Jonathan Nolan are just... They had a question, and they just, like, spent this movie trying to answer it, which is basically just, like, is there anything out there that transcends time and space? And if it is there, like, is it kind of within us, or is it, like, just something other than us? And to me, that hit this time. And I wanted to just say this. This movie marries, like, the cosmic with the personal in a way that I think Terrence Malick was trying to do with Tree of Life. But Tree of Life, it does not work. It works for me in this. Like, the cosmic and the personal, they connect for me in this.
I actually agree with you on that.
Boom.
Except it does work for me in Tree of Life. But we're not talking about Tree of Life today.
No. Maybe one day when I decide I'll rewatch it, we can have that conversation. But
the gentleman that I was talking about Tree of Life with, I love that we brought this full circle. The gentleman that I was talking about it with, he said he did not understand it the first time, but that he went back and watched it solely to figure out what was going on.
Mm.
And it was, he was like, by the third time, I got it. Oh, and God. I was like, I like this one.
But no, I was sitting in the theater and like Tree of Life popped into my head and I go, why?
Well, because Nolan.
I know why.
Big fan of Malick.
I'm fully aware.
Yeah.
But I'm saying why in the sense of like, ugh, not in the sense of like why.
Oh, I see, I see.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Interstellar is a much better film.
Oh, yeah, for yeah, sure.
There's no shot that
yeah.
this one's much better. I also gave it a 5 out of 5. I always will. This was one of my, in teenage years, one of the big movies that like influenced me wanting to go to film school or like learn more about the art of filmmaking. So I have it to thank for that, as well as like just overall interest in space. I've always, if I hadn't have gone into film, I would have wanted to go to space.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Who doesn't want to go to space? I want to go to space now.
I don't think my mom wants to go.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah. She's not into that. But, yeah, it's just fantastic. I wrote down something that's to what you were talking about. That, you know, I talked about briefly the visuals. This is the first collaboration between Nolan and Hoytema.
Yeah.
Previously, he worked with Wally Pfister.
Right.
But the, and then there's all these VFX that are captured in camera. But to me, the biggest effect in this movie is love. Because in those scenes in the Tesseract or on the other planets, the thing that transcends that for me is love. And it's almost like what you're talking about,
yes,
the idea of it transcending the cosmos, it transcends the VFX. I don't give a crap about it looking like fantastic or, you know, the CGI or it being in camera. It's the fact that the performance in this movie is so raw and authentic.
You know, to me, the whole like love thing in this movie, if it wouldn't have outright said it, like, we got it.
Right.
But the movie feels the need to tell you that. Like, it feels the need to go ahead and explain, like, this is all about love, by the way. In case you missed that part of the movie, that's, I was like, well, I didn't need that. But, again, still a 5 out of 5.
Still a 5 out of 5. I think
a little nitpicky on me, I guess, on my part.
I mean, I think it definitely works the first time you see it.
Yeah.
It definitely works for people that are not, like, as big into breaking down movies.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk to people who know about, because Christopher Nolan's actually really well known outside of film bro circles,
right?
Which
yeah,
is because of the Batman films, Inception, mm-hmm. and this one. And it's interesting because when you talk to people about Dunkirk, Tenet, or Oppenheimer, a lot of times they're comparing it to this one. I know people that compared Oppenheimer to Interstellar, and we're like, I don't understand why Oppenheimer wasn't big like Interstellar was.
Right, yeah.
And they're very different films.
Right, yeah. They're definitely not the same thing.
No, but they're both about love.
At the end of the day, I guess.
Or are they? I don't know.
I don't know either.
What's this podcast even about?
Dude, I have no idea.
Wow.
Yeah.
Maybe it is about love.
At the end of the day, that's what it's all about.
Yeah. Any other thoughts on Interstellar?
Oh, I was just going to say this because I thought about it just now. For your top five list, I was expecting to see the following there.
You know, I was trying to break your expectations of what I'd put.
Well, you did, because that was the one I was like, that one's definitely going to be on this list.
Can I move that to honorable mentions?
Yeah, and then for sure.
Suppose it might replace Nim's Island if I actually make a list.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's been so long since I've seen
it. I mean, there's no rules to the thing. You just kind of do it.
That's true. We're kind of making our own rules.
Yeah, we're just here.
Wow. Well, I think that going back to Interstellar, though, I have one last little statement. When it comes to the title of the podcast,
mm-hmm.
why we watch movies, Interstellar is an example of why I personally watch a film.
Yeah.
Is to feel moved and to feel connected to the characters and to like walk away with something that I right. didn't previously have. And I think every time I see this film, that happens.
Yeah, me too. I think it's also there. I mean, all of the filmmaking too, because like, again, it is massive, like in scale and like the ambition of this. Like, they're on different planets, and they all have different like landscapes that they're, you know, everything about this movie. I think, like, Christopher Nolan just kind of upped the scale.
Yeah,
and it worked for me. And I know a lot of people have issues with it, but like, this is kind of like peak, like, cinema, like sitting in the theater. It was a great experience.
Right. I saw, and this will be the last thing I say about it, because I always have to bring it back to Terry.
Oh, God, terrible Terry.
In the trailer for his most recent film, A Hidden Life, it opens with a quote about the film from one of the reviewers. It might have been Variety. I'm not sure. That's irrelevant. And it says, "Cinema at its mightiest and holiest is a cathedral of the senses in which you enter."
Yeah, that sounds like something he would say.
Well, it wasn't Terrence Malick. It was someone saying that about his film.
Oh, it sounds like a Terrence Malick fan talking about Terrence Malick.
But it's how I feel about Christopher Nolan as well.
I don't have the love for Christopher Nolan that you do. That's true. I think this one and Oppenheimer are kind of the exception. Oh, and the Batman movies. But
do the Batman movies really count?
I mean, I count them, but
I feel like they're just so different from everything else he's done.
I mean, for sure. But yeah, I'm not a Nolan fanboy for sure.
That's okay. You don't have to be.
Yeah. But I'm an Interstellar truther, I'll say that.
Yeah. Just like I'm a Gaylor Swift apologist and a Zack Snyder DC films apologist.
Word. Rebel Moon wasn't as bad as everybody said. It wasn't good, but
it wasn't not good. It was pretty bad.
It was just
But that's for another episode.
That is. Maybe when part two comes out, we can just review them both.
That, I like that, actually. Yeah, stay tuned for that, y'all. But anyways, thank you all for listening to this episode of This Is Why We Watch Movies. Again, you can follow us on Letterboxd, link in the description below. And we'll see you in the next one.